The 20th century was the first where technology enabled forms of violent state competition as well as peaceful globalization across the full scale of the Earth. Moreover, the same technology made possible the organization of massive state systems to project power and maintain integrated, centralized control over large, diverse populations and cultures. The Best in Bitcoin Made Audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to the show. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And this is Bitcoin Audible. And today, March 13th, 2023, Bitcoin Audible is 5 years old. And I only know that because my wife put Bitcoin Audible's birthday on my calendar. But I shared that on Noster, and a lot of you guys zapped the hell out of that post. So I just wanted to say thank you. Thank you so much. It's pretty crazy to think that this thing is 5 years old. I have been a podcaster for a massive chunk of my professional life now. Like, I wasn't an internet technician for 5 years. I think it was like 4.5. But anyway, just, it's crazy. Time flies. And Bitcoin, I'm a little shocked that Bitcoin has not gotten boring to me yet. That I still am just fascinated about reading about this stuff every single day and digging more into the new developments. In fact, it's gotten more exciting. There's so many new things. And like with Noster and Keat and kind of and Lightning and everything like happening in like kind of the second and third layer, it's like it's finally becoming its own internet. Like it's truly changing the architecture of how information travels and how we monetize infrastructure. So it feels like the opposite of getting boring. It feels like it's like really beginning to get exciting. And then all of this geopolitical stuff is unfolding. And holy crap, now we're going to see how this plays into the political sphere. So it's going to be orders of magnitude more impactful in exactly how it plays a role in the world. And actually, that is what we are going to read today. So on Read 710, we are diving into a piece by Matthew Pines that I read that I've been sitting on for a little bit and wanting to get back to, called The Future Geopolitical Order and Bitcoin, talking about how they fit together and how to assess the situation. Like it's an initial assessment is the subtitle, but it is a really, really good piece. It brings together a lot of, and in fact, it brings into it a number of different things that I wasn't perfectly aware of, or little tidbits that if you ask me about details of these things, I would have left them out, and they are actually important details. So this is just a really, really good piece to kind of wrap your head around both the micro, in fact, he lays it out. It's the micro, the meso, and the macro environment and the major pieces involved. And I think that's probably something that I don't focus on too much is I tend to just kind of ignore the micro and think that the meso is mostly like the middle ground is just kind of a consequence of the macro stuff. I tend to focus on the macro, the big picture, the monetary history, all of that sort of thing. And, I think he has a really good framing in this, and it's a really fun piece. So we will be breaking this up into two parts because I just don't have the time to finish it all, and we will jump right into it really quick. Let's thank our sponsor, and then we will dive in. And we have the best sponsors. We got the Fold Card, the card that literally pays me sats for using fiat. I have a debit card that pays me sats back on everything that I buy. And honestly, it's become one of those, like, I really, really treasure those sats because it's like the reward for still being forced to use fiat. And it is a very significant savings in, like, just building up over time. And it is so low friction. Like, I'm not doing anything different. I just switched to a different debit card and a different account from, like, a boring bank to the Fold card and the Fold app. If you aren't doing this and you're in the U.S., you have got to check it out and get 20,000 free sats just for looking into it. That link will be in the show notes. So if you're looking for some free sats, all the different ways, do check it out. And then also Swan Bitcoin, the premium Bitcoin onboarding service. They've got a remarkable team. They have got an automatic savings account and automatic withdrawal. You know, all this banking stuff going on, anything going on with exchanges. I know the Bitcoin just comes to me after I buy it. All I do is I get the email and I'm like, yeah, send it to me. Boom, it's in my cold card. It's in my cold storage. And on that note, they also happen to be a sponsor of the show. CoinKite has all of the best devices for securing your Bitcoin. The cold card Mark IV, you can get 9% off with code BitcoinAudible. Plus, they have so many other great hardware solutions. Devices and tap signers and all of these other things. I highly recommend it. They're just amazing tools for keeping your Bitcoin safe. Thank you to all of them for making this show possible and for providing such awesome products and services for Legai. With that, we will jump right into our read. And this one is on the ever-fruitful Bitcoin Magazine. And it is titled, The Future Geopolitical Order and Bitcoin, An Initial Assessment, written by Matthew Pines. The days move along with regularity, one day indistinguishable from the next, a long continuous chain. Then suddenly, there is change. Travis Bickle, Taxi Driver, 1976. On February 26, 2022, a mere 3 days after Russia launched its invasion of Ukraine, the European Commission, France, Germany, Italy, the United Kingdom, Canada, and the United States released a, quote, joint statement on further restrictive economic measures. This statement, joined by Japan 2 days later, declared how the group of seven G7 nations will, quote, commit to imposing restrictive measures that will prevent the Russian central bank from deploying its international reserves. This unprecedented sanction had the effect of freezing Russia's ability to access about half of its $600 billion of foreign reserves. And with a stroke of a pen, what Russia thought was its money one day turned out not to be overnight. Amid the fast-moving events of that period and additional sanctions since applied, the strategic import of this particular action was somewhat obscured. However, history will likely note that move as marking a fundamental pivot in the evolution of the international economic system and the associated global order. The lesson Russia learned in February was also learned by the Canadian truckers and many others in recent history, and brings into sharp relief a question that hits at the core of the current monetary and political arrangement. What is money, and who has the power to decide? Money is an expression of power. The power to decide what money is and who can or cannot use it is a unique and consequential power. How such power is wielded, whether in the hands of a state, across blocks of competing states, or among a distributed consensus of individuals, will shape much of the future. This essay outlines an abridged analytical framework for understanding the global system at distinct scales, micro, meso, and macro, and presents a plausible, albeit notional, scenario of how geopolitical dynamics may precipitate a monetary shakeup in which Bitcoin becomes strategically important. Analytical framework. Why should things be easy to understand? Thomas Pynchon, 1977. Any future scenario analysis must be grounded on an understanding of the current global system. To do so, we must simplify and impose some crude conceptual schema that puts the key domains of interest into some relation to one another. Then we can import relevant empirical details from these domains to examine their historical and potentially causal relationship to one another. To the extent we have done this successfully, we can say, quote, "We understand how things work," but only in an approximate and inherently limited way. We must recognize that there are entire academic disciplines with mountains of literature devoted to understanding every element of the global system. It would be hubris of the highest order to suppose one could construct some synoptic perspective across all these domains. For the purposes of this initial assessment, I examine three broad domains for the global system: micro, meso, and macro. See table. Micro domain. Since our core question relates to the future of the global monetary system, it is critical that we understand the tactical constraints, technical mechanisms, and near-term dynamics of the current money system. The dominant constraint facing the policy officials responsible for this system is global debt levels, which have reached levels typically associated with the aftermath of world wars. At this point, the technical mechanisms available relate to the ability to manage institutional demand for sovereign debt securities and attempt to ensure that the market for such securities remains sufficiently liquid and stable against a backdrop of rising inflation. As the G30 Working Group on Treasury Market Liquidity has noted, the smooth functioning of the U.S. debt market is absolutely imperative for the stability of the global financial system. As a result, the Federal Reserve has had to develop extensive facilities that increase the moneyness of U.S. Treasury securities by increasing their fungibility as a cash equivalent and shore up this $23 trillion+ market. These efforts have come in halting response to periodic disruptions to the UST market after the global financial crisis. The first signs of disturbance appeared with the flash rally in 2014, then the repo spike in 2019, and the particularly concerning sell-off in March of 2020, when the secondary market for US Treasuries essentially froze. In addition, while written off as an operational error, the technical failure of the Fedwire system on February 25, 2021 left a lasting imprint in the debt market. The Fed also invoked its emergency authorities under Section 13(3) of the Federal Reserve Act to deploy an unprecedented series of lending and credit facilities in coordination with the Treasury Department. The net effect of these changes have been to substantially broaden the number of counterparties or financial institutions with access to the Fed's balance sheet. These monetary facilities, specifically the Overnight Reverse Repo Facility, ONRRP, and the Standing Repo Facility, or SRF, serve to provide a floor and ceiling, respectively, to money market and dollar funding markets, with an effectively unlimited ceiling at the FOMC's discretion to raise caps as needed. The Fed has also expanded its dollar liquidity and foreign currency liquidity swap lines with foreign central banks to prevent obstruction in the key arteries in the global dollar system. While typically limited to countries with a close relationship to the US, for example, the UK, Canada, the EU, Japan, and Switzerland, a crisis like COVID-19 saw these broadly expanded to many others. However, not all major foreign central banks have access to these facilities, most notably China. To cover this gap in its ability to manage global dollar funding markets, the New York Fed executes repo and reverse repo transactions through its Foreign and International Monetary Authorities, or FIMA, F-I-M-A. While not publicly acknowledged, it's understood that the dominant FIMA customer is China. This facility allows China to borrow dollars directly from the Fed without selling treasury holdings. In a time of treasury market stress by foreign selling of U.S. treasuries like that seen in March of 2020, the Fed will print new dollars and give those to China in exchange for U.S. Treasury collateral. This thicket of technical facilities, repo facilities, swap lines, emergency credit lines, asset purchases, etc., form the essential plumbing by which the current monetary authorities will seek to manage a global economic system facing high debt loads, especially public debt, low structured growth potential from declining demography, and high inflation. The latter is exacerbated by an endogenous demand shock from stimulus policies in the West and an exogenous supply shock from the war in Ukraine. These shorter-run technical aspects of the monetary microdomain will influence and constrain the operational factors and decisions over the medium term, the mesodomain, to which we now turn our attention. Mesodomain. The operational constraints and decision points facing Western sovereigns at this level are multifarious. First, the Fed's attempt to normalize interest rates and shrink its system open market account, SOMA, via quantitative tightening will run into difficulty drawing down the $1.7 trillion in overnight reverse repo for a U.S. Treasury bid, as leveraged relative value hedge funds hit dealer balance sheet capacity and as potential cash investors keep their holdings in money market funds to capture rising yields. These factors will constrain the private market's ability to absorb U.S. Treasury issuance, and thus its ability to help refinance the mountain of maturing securities in the next few years. The Standing Repo Facility, or SRF, and FEMA will not be helpful here, as these are merely repo facilities, so authorities may move to increase requirements for institutions to hold high-quality liquid assets, or HQLA, namely U.S. Treasuries. This may take the form of unilateral Fed action or a coordinated update to Basel III, which is the current set of international regulations that mandate certain capital ratios of financial institutions to be held in safe and liquid assets, quote-unquote, like U.S. Treasuries. In addition, it is likely that some form of central clearing of U.S. Treasuries will be introduced in the UST market, building on the recently instituted sponsored service by the Fixed Income Clearing Corporation. Collectively, these amount to attempts of increasingly corralling large pools of institutional capital into holding U.S. Treasuries, and at the same time, tightly controlling the use of leverage and derivatives in the U.S. Treasury market. Essentially, this is the world's largest sovereign debtor, forcing its captive financial industry to own its increasingly unattractive debts and limit potentially, quote, disruptive trading activities. In short, the U.S. government will not and cannot allow a free market in U.S. Treasuries. This may sound obvious to Bitcoiners who point out that the Fed's very existence as a monetary agent is proof that the market for money isn't free. Point taken. But setting a target for the overnight federal funds rate, and even making large-scale asset purchases, for example quantitative easing, is qualitatively different from effectively nationalizing the U.S. Treasury market and embarking on a form of, quote, yield curve control to monetize sovereign debt indefinitely. This is the Hotel California the U.S. is about to check into. Secondly, the structure of global commodity markets has become highly financialized, leveraged, and therefore fragile. After the Commodity Futures Modernization Act of 2000 passed, the amount of open interest in the commodities markets increased from around 20% to 80-90%, representing an explosion in financial speculation as the primary driver of commodity pricing. The market has become increasingly concentrated with a handful of dominant commodity trading houses, for example, Trafigura, Glencore, Vital, Unipec, etc., that all finance their highly leveraged operations through central clearing counterparties, or CCPs. The purpose of these CCPs is to mutualize credit risk among member institutions, but the value-at-risk models these CCPs use to set the initial margin requirements are based on short or 5 to 10 year look-back periods. Needless to say, these models were not trained for a scenario where the world's largest commodity exporter, Russia, is hit by coordinated G7 sanctions and an insurance blockade on shipping, nor one where the world's largest goods producer, China, is shutting down its factories and ports in waves of COVID-19 lockdowns. The result has been, and will continue to be, wild swings in commodities markets that threaten to bankrupt commodity trading houses, for example, Trafigura, question the solvency of CCPs, and force potential bailouts. Moreover, these CCPs have unlimited recourse to the balance sheets of their members, namely globally systemically important banks, GSIBs, to keep themselves solvent in a liquidity event. Nationalizations or quasi-nationalizations aren't off the table, especially as China's state-owned trading house, UniPEC, is poised to take market share in the geostrategically critical and deeply murky commodity markets. It is important to note that it is these very same GSIB, or Global Systemically Important Bank balance sheets, that are supposed to absorb securities rolling off of central bank balance sheets via quantitative tightening, and to absorb increasing U.S. Treasury issuance. These GSIB balance sheets, while nominally attached to private banks, function in the post-Basel III environment as public utilities. That is, they exist as effective extensions of the central bank and are captive agents to facilitate the financing of sovereigns by whose remit and legal mandate they exist in the first place. Thus, there could come a point where the increasing volatility and financial stress from geopolitically disruptive commodity markets encumbers the ability of banks to support off-balance sheet financing of their fiscal authorities. This leaves RV, relative value hedge funds, and the Bank of Japan as the sole material remaining significant external bids for the U.S. Treasury market. RV hedge funds buy treasuries, short the futures, and fund the pair in the repo market, a strategy that blew up in September 2019 and March 2020, and was only saved by floods of central bank liquidity. RV funds are a form of fast funding, which flee at the first sign of trouble, and will find it hard to harvest bond bases during quantitative tightening. That is, they are not the ideal source upon which the world's greatest superpower should depend for financing. The Bank of Japan, on the other hand, has been among the most reliable buyers of U.S. debt. Facing deflation at home and persistently low rates of return, the Japanese saver has gorged on U.S. treasuries, eager for any meager yield spread. As a result, Japan has the largest net international investment position, or NIIP, in the world. The Bank of Japan, as the proverbial laboratory of central bank experimentation, is a guide to where other Western monetary authorities will head as they follow Japan's demographic trajectory. Led by the charismatic Haruhiko Kuroda, the Bank of Japan has implemented the most extreme monetary policy on the planet. Starting with quantitative and qualitative monetary easing, QQE, in 2013, then adding negative interest rate policy, or NERP, in early 2016, and then QQE with yield curve control in June 2016, which is a program of unlimited Japanese government bond, or JGB, buying to keep the yield on 10-year JGBs fixed at 25 basis points. This policy has been mostly unremarkable in a low inflation environment. However, the inflationary effects from post-COVID liquidity injections and the Ukraine war commodity shock is putting that policy to an unprecedented test, forcing the Bank of Japan to execute many unscheduled open market operations to defend the peg. The pressure on the JGB market has been released in the form of a weakening yen, especially against the US dollar. Why does this matter? Well, this presents a potential fracture point in the key funding channel by which Japanese money flows into the US Treasury market. In fact, the correlation between the Japanese government bond 10-year and the USDJPY, or dollar to Japanese yen, and the US 10-year bond is very high. That is, the strength and durability of the Japanese bid for U.S. treasuries may now be weakening. given their role as one of the few remaining sources of external demand for U.S. debt, any instability or change in Bank of Japan policy could have massive ramifications for the U.S. Treasury market, and by extension, the stability of the global dollar system, which depends on that market to remain well-ordered. Now, monetary policy decisions, despite the lip service paid to central bank independence, are fundamentally political, and in the current environment, geopolitical. Thus, any analysis of the constraints facing Bank of Japan decision-makers must take account of the long history of the U.S.-Japan diplomatic relationship, of their membership in the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue, given their mutual interest in maintaining the G7-dominated economic system, containing China and promoting democratic values. Given the particular threat of China and the rising defense ties with the U.S., one should expect Japan to be accommodating, if not subservient, to the monetary stability needs of the U.S., even at the cost of their currency and domestic economy. Japan is particularly vulnerable to higher-cost energy inputs, as liquid natural gas imports continue to be directed to Europe to blunt the force of Putin's energy blackmail. In short, Japan is one of the few remaining Jenga blocks holding up the rickety U.S. Treasury system upon which the U.S. economic and geopolitical hegemony depends. Zooming out further, the third mesoscale constraint facing sovereigns in the current geopolitical order relates the commodity and food shocks already mentioned. The knock-on effects in countries around the world from rising food and energy prices, or even shortages, will lead to domestic political instability. Rich countries will increase subsidies to placate local populations, but this will exacerbate global food and energy stress in emerging markets, already facing a debt crisis from a rising dollar. This is a recipe for civil disorder and war in the developing world, at the same time that Western nations who would normally be poised to respond with, quote, peacekeeping missions, will find themselves preoccupied with their own domestic affairs and larger international crises to manage. While the acute shock from war will force substitution on the margin and will mellow with time, albeit at a structurally higher level, the lesson learned by nations and firms around the world will persist. Coming on the heels of the supply chain disruptions from COVID-19, this lesson is twofold. One, national leaders now know that critical commodity inputs, for example from Russia, and finished goods supply chains, for example from China, dominated by hostile or politically antagonistic nations, can and will be weaponized. And two, Western multinationals and their C-suites that have only known the deflationary cost savings from globalization, i.e. offshoring for labor arbitrage, will confront a great reversion of reshoring, which will be strongly encouraged, if not required, by overt sovereign industrial policies. The value of domestic reserves, of hard resources, not mere foreign exchange, of domestic production capacity, and of reliable and, quote, friendly supply chains, now have geopolitical premiums attached. In addition to this reshoring and restocking trend driven by rising geopolitical risk, states will seek to rearm. This is happening in Europe in immediate response to Russia's invasion, with Germany reversing decades of defense policy to embark on a program of massive military buildup, NATO discussing expanding permanent bases, and even France raising the possibility of a standing European army. This trend will ricochet, with every state reconsidering their strategic position, their reliance on critical resources, for example farmland, ports, gas fields, etc., and eyeing any neighbors that they may suspect harbor revanchist ambitions in their territory. The net result will be larger portions of GDP dedicated to defense spending, a particularly unproductive form of investment that will not help already indebted nations grow themselves out of ever-tightening debt traps. Finally, despite having certain aspects of the green dream shattered by the cold reality of fossil fuel dependence, and thus dependence on OPEC regimes, most Western nations will not give up on their Paris Climate Accord commitments. In fact, many are likely to see the crises of 2022 as a precipitating event to accelerate investment in, quote, rebuilding domestic energy systems. This will require rapidly expanding, less carbon-intensive power generation, broad-scale electrification of the economy, and radical transformation of how grids are structured and managed. The combination of this reshoring, restocking, rearming, and rebuilding will be a new structurally inflationary force that is likely to overwhelm the latent deflationary trend from demographics and technology. Further, this is a trend that is immune to the business cycle, as the outlays are strategically necessary to support national security imperatives. These mesoscale forces will interact constructively, in the fluid dynamic sense, with the microscale variables of U.S. Treasury market weakness, commodity finance fragility, and associated macroeconomic fragility to place the current geopolitical order at high risk of fracture. Macro domain. Sociopolitical changes and technology shifts tend to be the dominant macro-structural influences over time. However, given the current geopolitical crisis, the imminent contest for global power may unfold as the deciding factor shaping the evolution of the global system and its associated monetary regime. The question of the role of Bitcoin in this current conflict and potential future order or disorder can then be analyzed. It is important to recognize that global geography imposes a first-order constraint on the geopolitical order. The size of the Eurasian landmass, along with its limited oceanic access and endogenous natural resources, sets the frame for its power potential. The British geographer Harold Mackinder developed a broad schema for analysis of world history through the lens of his heartland theory of Eurasia, captured in a simple triplet. 1. Who rules Eastern Europe commands the heartland, i.e. the Eurasian core. 2. Who rules the heartland commands the world island, i.e. Asia and Europe. And 3. Who rules the world island commands the world. This framework lends itself to viewing geopolitical conflict as a nexus naturally arising between land and sea powers, which in modern history presented itself in various iterations of contest between, to borrow the framing used in Orwell's 1984, Eurasia, Oceania, and East Asia. The 20th century was the first where technology enabled forms of violent state competition, as well as peaceful globalization, across the full scale of the Earth. Moreover, the same technology made possible the organization of massive state systems to project power and maintain integrated, centralized control over large, diverse populations and cultures. The Soviet Union emerged from that era of global conflict as the Eurasian model of such a technologically enabled state structure, inspired by a state-focused political and economic ideology, and inherently constrained and empowered by its responsibility over the Eurasian heartland. The United States arose as the dynamic pole to the USSR, similarly technology-enabled, but inspired by a radically different political and economic model, inherited from its maritime and commercial forebears, Great Britain, to take the helm as the great oceanic power. The Cold War can thus be seen as a modern incarnation of this geographically contingent dynamic, pitting the greatest land power of the era against the greatest sea power. The U.S. viewed this competition as an existential contest for control over the world order, which in the first decades after World War II was not a settled question. Starting in 1964, the Brezhnev era saw a massive military buildup, crushing the Prague Spring in 1968, and relatively high economic growth, 5-8% annual GDP growth. But fractures after Mao launched the Cultural Revolution gave the U.S. an opening to split the communist power bloc dominating Eurasia. President Nixon's trip to China in 1972 successfully launched a multi-decade strategic partnership between the U.S. and China to mutually counter and contain the Soviet Union. In the course of these geopolitical developments, the global monetary system also underwent dramatic shifts. The Bretton Woods Agreement, forged in 1944, which fixed a gold exchange rate for the US dollar, against which other countries pegged their currencies, very quickly proved to be unworkable. An offshore eurodollar system developed to help the Soviets store and recycle dollars in European banks in the 1950s, and the rising price of gold challenged the US dollar peg, leading to the creation of the London Gold Pool in 1961. Gold continued to be drained from the pool as the US increased deficits to finance the Vietnam War. France publicly withdrew, and the pool quickly collapsed. Emergency efforts to keep the system afloat led to a two-tiered gold price that was fundamentally unstable as reserves continued to drain from the treasury. Finally, in 1971, Nixon, quote, temporarily suspended convertibility, and the global monetary system shifted entirely to a free-floating exchange rate system, which we live with to this day. Now, as dramatic as these official moves were, the private market for money never ceased to evolve. U.S. authorities, mostly in the dark about the workings of this offshore eurodollar system, awoke to the strategic possibilities after the Nixon shock and engineered a new basis for support for the dollar. The solution they caught on to involved scaling up a mechanism that had already been built over years for commodity exporters, namely the oil producers in the Middle East, to recycle their dollar surpluses into U.S. Treasury securities, an asset considered to be the most safe and liquid instrument for sovereign savings and foreign exchange reserves. Nixon dispatched his Treasury Secretary to manage shuttle diplomacy with Saudi Arabia in 1973 that resulted in a grand bargain. The kingdom would agree to solely denominate its oil sales in dollars and recycle those revenues into the U.S. sovereign bond market and arms deals in exchange for military protection for its regime. This inaugurated what is colloquially known as the petrodollar, but it should probably be termed the petro-treasury, as the key feature of this system is not really the unit of account for oil pricing, but the reserve asset into which oil sales then had to flow. The U.S. proceeded to expand and replicate this system in other nations throughout the century, in particular with Germany and Japan. Compare the Plaza Accords. Two other rising industrial powers with large export surpluses that needed to be redirected into U.S. capital markets. The success of this system helped the U.S. outspend the Soviets via an arms race until they collapsed in 1991. The U.S. seized on the opportunity to cement total global domination and capture strategic influence over the Eurasian heartland. It sent the, quote, Harvard boys into Moscow to implement shock therapy, a crash program of market liberalization, at least nominally, intended to remake Russia into a modern, Western-oriented capitalist state. Instead, the chaos unleashed led to a breakdown of civil order, hyperinflation, and the rise of mafia organizations infused with former and still-serving intelligence officers. The takeover of the state by these Siloviki, with President Putin at the helm, instead set Russia back on a course of authoritarianism, the consequences of which we witness today. The U.S. also attempted to apply a similar strategic approach to China, the second pole of the Eurasian power axis, during that hyperpower moment of global hegemony. While Russia was weak, it turned attention to China, bringing them into the World Trade Organization in 2001. This marked a pivot point in globalization, as Western firms tripped over each other to relocate factories to China. It also turbocharged the dollar treasury recycling system as the U.S. ran persistent trade deficits to gorge on cheap goods and electronics. China agreed to play along for the first phase of this new relationship, piling their U.S. dollar surpluses back into U.S. treasuries, and becoming the U.S. government's largest creditor, thereby helping to indirectly finance our Afghanistan and Iraq wars, and giving political cover for continued deficit spending by both parties, of tax cuts, increasing social programs, and the one-way ratchet of defense outlays. They even balked at a suggestion by the Russians in 2008 to coordinate a fire sale of U.S. debt securities at the height of the financial crisis. China fundamentally pivoted its approach to the dollar system after the taper tantrum in 2013 revealed that the Fed would never realistically be able to exit quantitative easing. That same year, President Xi announced the Belt and Road Initiative, or the BRI. The Belt and Road Initiative is an economic expression of Mackinder's thesis, with a monetary twist. Instead of recycling net surpluses into U.S. treasuries, China instead decided to re-lend those dollars to countries throughout the Eurasian heartland and periphery, even deeply into Africa and South America, to secure financial interests in hard assets, natural resources, and spread political influence, all on the back of King Dollar. At the same time, China realized the strategic value of acquiring more valuable Western assets and proceeded to pour its dollar surpluses into U.S. and European equity and real estate markets. As episodes like the NBA, Marriott, and other corporate controversies attest, these capital flows have not come without political strings attached. More perniciously, Chinese investment in firms at the core of the national defense industrial base have threatened the protection of intellectual property and supported the Chinese acquisition of technology to accelerate their defense modernization. At this point, it is clear that maintaining the dollar's status as the global reserve currency, and more importantly, the U.S. Treasury's status as the global reserve asset, has not accrued to the U.S. the exorbitant privilege as commonly understood. Rather, we now find ourselves forced to run increasingly large and persistent trade deficits that undermine our domestic manufacturing capacity, leaving us acutely vulnerable to supply chains anchored in China. Further, the U.S. is forced to recycle and reabsorb global savings, which pushes up asset prices to the benefit of a select Wall Street elite. This drives increasing wealth inequality and associated social and political polarization, all while giving up ownership of scarce, valuable assets in exchange for cheap, perishable consumer goods. If the geopolitical imperative of the U.S. in the post-war era was to ensure no single power bloc would emerge to dominate Eurasia, it's hard not to look at the no-limit strategic partnership announced by Xi and Putin in February of 2022 as anything other than a catastrophe. Russia's war in Ukraine and China's tacit assent can thus be seen as the first overt move in a larger contest to challenge the Western rules-based international order. Given that monetary regimes are downstream of the prevailing geopolitical order, the question of the future of the global monetary system and the role of Bitcoin in such a future system thus resolves to the question of how this present geopolitical crisis may unfold. At present time, one can imagine a wide range of scenarios. In a time of war, many things can go wrong. Leaders can miscalculate. Irrationality, whim, or strategic indecision have steered the course of history towards disaster many times in the past. In other words, shit happens. No one has a crystal ball, and critical events may play out more rapidly than anticipated. At the same time, it may take much longer than one would think for these cascading strategic implications to unfold. With those caveats, let us close this essay with a sketch of a plausible scenario, outlining how the key dynamics across the domains described above may play out, in particular, with respect to the changing geopolitical order and associated monetary regime. In such a scenario, we can see how Bitcoin may become particularly relevant, and we can assess the implications for strategic decision makers as they confront a rapidly changing global system. Scenario analysis. All right, that's where we're going to have to stop for today. I am out of time. And I will also, I wanted to share that I will be on the Bitcoin.review podcast tomorrow with MVK and the crew. We're going to be talking about going over all sorts of things with like new technical updates and things landing. And then also, I got to hang out with John Vallis today. Some of you may have already seen it. He did it live. Had an awesome discussion just about all the craziness that is going on. And I will be covering some things probably pretty soon as well. I'll be digging into a lot of the stuff that's going on here on the show, but that's probably a decent precursor for, because we did get into a lot of what's happening with, you know, signature, all the banking crisis stuff that's beginning to unravel and government response to it. But I also haven't really done like some concrete digging into a lot of these things. Mostly I've just been kind of observing these like last couple of weeks as things have begun to unfold. And I intend to do a much more serious dive, especially into some of the theories about the contest between LIBOR and SOFOR, and that the Federal Reserve and the European Central Bank may actually be at odds. There's some very interesting narratives and ideas being tossed out as to why certain decisions are being made and what it could mean going forward for QE, inflation and all of these things. So there's a lot to unpack. There's a lot to unpack, and I'm trying to read and understand as much as I can to hopefully get into a really good guy's take on this one. And I may even read, a lot of people I think saw the post that I did on Twitter where I just kind of ranted, which hat tip to Alan Farrington, by the way. He had a really good post on Noster that just kind of got me riled up and got me thinking about it. And I couldn't do anything else until I dumped that onto social media, because it was just kind of like taking over my brain for a little while. It was driving me crazy. So glad I got that out, and hat tip to Alan Farrington always for the awesome inspiration. So with that, just a thank you to everyone who, for the Bitcoin Audible birthday wishes. It's not my birthday anymore, but it is Bitcoin Audible's 5-year anniversary. So thank you guys. It's pretty epic to think. It's crazy to think I've been doing this for 5 years. And what's really funny is that I've a little bit come full circle, because I've got much better equipment, but my very first episode I actually did, right here on this bed, holding my phone, talking into my phone. And I am now sitting right here on the bed talking into my, you know, Shure MV7 microphone, which I am just holding up in front of my face. So even after 5 years, I don't really have a good dedicated space to record. I just kind of make it up as I go along. And, you know, a lot of times it seems to work. Everybody thinks my basement, I've done a couple of video shows. Everybody thinks the basement is like a backdrop. No, it's there. That's where I am doing a lot of my work now. And all of my guest appearances are in the cement, the concrete unfinished basement, which we are drawing up some exact plans for, hopefully, right now. Fingers crossed, it's going to be. It is going to have a studio and an amazing downstairs sometime soon. I don't know the timeline. It's never what I think it's going to be, but I'm going to make it happen. So it is closer than it has ever been, and it continues to inch its way forward. And I will take the rest of the night to relax a little bit and enjoy the fact that Bitcoin Audible is 5 years old. Pretty crazy. And I've also gotten, I have not gathered them all together, but I've gotten a lot of Noster zaps and boosts and messages and stuff on Fountain. And I'm going to try to gather them all and thank everyone individually, because some of them have been pretty big and amazing and have some really great comments. So I will definitely be devoting another episode, hopefully very soon this week, to going through those, because there's some really great ones. So stay tuned. Thank you guys so much for listening. Don't forget to check out our amazing... Well, don't forget to check out Matthew Pines and the other things that he's writing. He's got a couple of... I think he's got a couple other things on Bitcoin Magazine, and I feel like I have some things saved from somewhere else. I don't know. I'll have to dig back through, but Matthew Pines comes up a lot, so I will definitely link to a Twitter page as well as the Bitcoin Magazine page so that you can check out him, his writing, and follow him on the socials. And if he's on Nostr, I'm not sure. Let's see. I'll find out if he's on Nostr, and I'll put the link in there as well. Thank you to Swan Bitcoin, to CoinKite, and to Fold for being such totems in my Bitcoin service and business life. You know, I've been using Swan since they started their auto purchase, their savings account, when that was all that they were. And they have since become the full-on, like, the onboarding and integration service with, like, everything Bitcoin. CoinKite, I mean, the cold card, the hardware wallets, the tap signers, the open dimes. They have an incredible suite of hardware devices and products. And, of course, Fold. I got sats back on everything. Oh, by the way, I've got, right at this moment, earlier today, my sats back that I've gotten were 19,699,699 sats. And I have like a couple things I need to spend for, and I don't want to spend for them because I don't know. I feel like I need to keep this number for some time. It feels like this is an important number. I don't know why, but that is a lot of freaking sats back. That's almost $5,000 worth after this little skyrocket in Bitcoin price. If you are not doing the Fold thing, you got to check it out. There's links to all of that good stuff in the show notes. And with that, I will catch you on tomorrow's episode with part 2 of the future geopolitical order and Bitcoin. And until then, everybody, take it easy, guys. Man has only one tool to fight error: reason. Ludwig von Mises.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.